Okay, and Phil, you don't mind, we record. Okay, so welcome all to the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. My name is David Kramer. I'm the director of this august institution, and it is our pleasure to welcome you here this evening to one of our series of book talks that we do through the year. This is a very special one, as you can tell. I'll never forget when my family, first got our dog years ago, and I had the New York Upper West Side experience with the dog that I think many, at least Jews with dogs, have. I guess if you're not a Jew with a dog, you wouldn't have this experience. And that is that I was walking my dog and wearing my kippah, going down into Riverside Park. And as I walked down the stairs into Riverside Park, there was a woman coming up the stairs obviously Hispanic from her accent. And she looks at me and the dog and she says, "You're Jewish?" I said, "Yeah." And she says, "And you've got a dog?" Right? And I said, "Yeah." And she clearly knew from one place or another that, you know, somehow, at least in some parts of modern Jewish culture, Jews and dogs are not supposed to go together. I discovered the full force of this not long thereafter when I had two friends who had actually been raised to fear dogs very deeply. They had been taught to cross the street if there were dogs on the sidewalk. Both of them grew up in Brooklyn, so if any of you are from Brooklyn, maybe you had this experience, or elsewhere. And I used my dog, who was very, very gentle, in a kind of dog therapy to help them overcome their fear. So, you know, from those experiences, I quickly grew to appreciate how powerful this relationship, both for positive and for negative, the relationship of Jews and dogs is. I think this is probably because Jews are people, and people have very powerful relationships with dogs, for good and bad. Some of you may have seen in the New York Times yesterday in the commentary section, right? You could see here, dogs are people too, right? So I see a dissenter over here. Well, I'm not going to take up too much of the time. I will only say beyond this that, as far as I know, this is the first time that dogs have openly been not only in the JTS library, but as far as I know, even on the JTS campus. I say openly because the chair of the library's advisory board owns two very, very little dogs. And she has snuck them onto the JTS campus in the past and brought them to my office. So officially, these may be the first, but unofficially, there have been others. You know why you're here. That is to hear a talk of one of the editors of, where's the volume? Are you saving a page here? Of this volume, A Jew's Best Friend? I would vote for yes, though this gentleman over here is voting for no, apparently. Oh, both. Okay, so you would agree on that one. Phil was a student here, has been a student, a friend, and a colleague for a long time. You know his biography from the announcement that we sent out. The only thing I would add, which he asked me to add, is that his new book, which is also mentioned on our announcement, The Business of Identity, Jews, Muslims, and Economic Life in Medieval Egypt, is to be published through Stanford University Press. When will it be available?
Next month. You can see it on Amazon now.
Oh, okay. So you can actually buy two books from Phil if you log on to your favorite source right after this event. And I invite you now, let's hear about Jews and Dogs.
Wonderful.
And, you know, David, if you have a little extra money still, you know, and you're on the Amazon page, you can also buy the Encyclopedia of Jews in the Islamic World, for which I was a section editor. It's about $900 there. So part of why I think this...
The library's already bought that, but...
Fortunately, I get a discounted additional copy. So let me say why I think The project is an interesting scholarly project. I think this is the case on a number of counts. One of them actually stems from the piece that that you just brought, David. Dogs are people too. That is to say, I'm a social historian. I work with questions of daily life. As David pointed out, my book that's coming out is about boring stuff like how people engaged in business transactions in medieval Egypt and tries to use business transactions. As a way of shedding light on Jewish identity in medieval Egypt. And so as someone who looks at these questions about daily life, I'm part of a tradition that's actually relatively new of what we might call social history. Right? So instead of looking at the upper echelons of society, the 1%, I try and take a look at the 98 or 99%. And so that involves looking at stuff, questions, as I said, of daily life. And I think that we've seen a transformation in historical studies in the last century or so, looking at women's history, at minority history, and a new frontier for us is animal studies. And at NYU, there actually is a new program in animal studies. I think increasingly on college campuses, we're seeing this as the next piece of what we might call kind of subaltern history, right? So women, minorities, and then the next frontier being animals. I wonder what the frontier after that will be. It could be machines, right? If we start imputing to machines some sense of personhood, giving some real grounding to Philip K. Dick's story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? So I was on a panel at AJS, our Association for Jewish Studies conference, a few years ago on animal studies in Judaism, and it really became clear that this is an area where Jewish studies is starting to catch up. That in other universities, places like NYU, animal studies are a piece of it, and hopefully this book is a contribution to what is becoming a field of its own. This is the Jewish piece. So let me talk about this idea that David pointed out, that perhaps some people were raised with a kind of antipathy towards dogs. I think that the regnant consensus of many folks, if you ask them, what does the tradition have to say about dogs, would be universally negative. So one of the folks who wrote in this book, again, the book itself is a collection of 12 scholarly articles written by colleagues from around the world, experts from around the world on the image of the dog throughout Jewish history, and then a pedagogical article that I tacked on to the end, how to use this book in an undergraduate course. Because remember, edited collections is like a little window into our world. Don't sell that well. But if you can use it as an adopted text for a course, you have a natural audience for that. And so the hope is that perhaps someone might do that. So I tacked on that article with my colleague, Catherine Baker, who was teaching at Vanderbilt in the Center for Teaching. Okay, so again, the regnant consensus, the idea that according to the tradition, dogs are bad. Here's a piece from Josh Schwartz, who teaches at Bar Ilan. Until recently, it was understood that dogs were held in contempt in Israelite society, and they were best known for their non-infrequent penchant for dining on carcasses and blood. The term dog itself was considered a derogatory appellation. The wording dead dog expressed humiliation and contempt, and the term dog's head apparently had a negative connotation. Dogs were considered urban predators, eagerly devouring carcasses and licking blood. The inhabitants of the cities in the land of Israel were probably accustomed to the spectacle of famished dogs roaming about at night, barking and howling in their search for food, familiar with the sight of a dog returns to its vomit. Such dogs were liable to attack humans, and the careless individual who drew too close, even if he or she showed affection to these creatures, would frequently be attacked or bitten. Those traveling in the countryside might also see wild dogs devouring carrion and licking blood. Indeed, biblical literature gave no hint, according to proponents of the negative view, that dogs received any sort of special treatment, let alone being thought of as pets. Again, this is not only the kind of regnant consensus for many folks in the scholarly domain, it's also what many of us kind of think in our kishkas, that dogs are, according to the tradition, to be avoided. One thing that my co-editor, Rakefet Zelotchik, and I discovered as we started to gather together the articles for the book is that as we look at every period in Jewish history, there is the official line, what we might see in classical texts, and there is what life actually looked like. Okay, and that might come, in my case, something that I might read between the lines in documents that emerge from daily life. In the case of the first article in the book by a character by the name of Meir Edrei, his article is called A Dog Cult in Ancient Israel. Edrei finds out that there are thousands of puppy skeletons buried in the land of Israel and asks the question, actually, was there a dog cult? Were there folks in ancient Israel who were sacrificing dogs ritually? Okay, not something we'd read about in the classical texts, but here, Edrei is able to kind of tease out, using the archaeological evidence, the possibility of a counter-tradition. Okay, and so at every stage of Jewish history, again, we see the kind of classical tradition, and we tease out a kind of a counter-tradition that describes a kind of a closeness between Jews and dogs. Okay, let me read a little piece from the summary to Edrei's article. Dogs were an inseparable part of everyday life in the ancient Near East, and were part of the cultic world as well. Dogs' positive and negative traits gave them a pivotal role in certain rituals of ancient Near Eastern cultures. It seems that the view of dogs as unclean, impure animals was more dominant among the cultures of the southern Levant, Israelites and Judeans included. As seen above, unclean animals could serve in rituals, mainly purifying healing rituals or rituals aimed at underworld deities. We've seen that the tradition of dog burials spanned a vast period of time and reached a pinnacle during the Persian period. Therefore, it's not surprising that the dog burials found in Jerusalem were dated to the very same time frame. It is possible that these dog burials were a local manifestation of the southern Levantine dog burial phenomenon, though it is also possible, if perhaps less likely, that this was an adaptation of the Persian dog ritual practice, dog burial practice brought back to Jerusalem by returning Judean exiles. If the Jerusalem dog burials are indeed dated to the Persian period, it could suggest Judean adaptation of a foreign cult that was widespread in the Persian period throughout the southern Levant, just as that against which the prophet Isaiah railed. What I find most interesting about this is that the tension between classical texts and the documents from daily life persists to the present day. As I said, the book spans the scope of Jewish history, starting with Edrei's article and finishing up with an article by a character by the name of Rabbi Dr. Aubrey Glazer, who's a rabbi in Harrison, New York. Now, Glazer's article looks at contemporary American, Jewish American rituals for dogs. Now, the way that the process worked for our putting the book together was we collected the articles from our colleagues, we sent them out for anonymous peer review. And my peer reviewer said about Aubrey's article, it's great that you have adoption rituals for dogs and burial rituals, but where is the bar mitzvah? Sounds like a joke, right? But if you look on YouTube, right, you'll see people celebrating bar mitzvahs. Now, as someone who's ordained as a rabbi, I find this abhorrent, okay? And in fact, Aubrey wrote in a footnote, right? He didn't even put it in the text of his article. There's a little footnote in which he discusses how uncomfortable people are with the very idea of the bar mitzvah. Here you go. Notwithstanding the apparent popularity of the bar mitzvah, its overall integration into the mainstream institutionalized ritual life remains an open question. As one reporter recently quipped, if only Mordechai Kaplan had thought of the bar mitzvah when he got the bat mitzvah rolling, just imagine how big the Reconstructionist movement's endowment would be. Okay? Granting animals the right to a party and a religion raises questions about the limits of ritual to recognize and project anthropocentric milestones onto sentient beings relative to their unique soul levels. There is often a fine line between ritual and entertainment that is too often violated in American culture as fetish. Not surprising, then, that conservative Rabbi Dan Satlow responded to Day's bar mitzvah as degrading of this sacred ritual. So, as a scholar of Jewish studies, right, this type of question makes me wonder, what exactly is Judaism, right? Is Judaism something that comes from a fetishized set of texts, from rabbinic leaders? Or do you have to also look at, what individuals who themselves believe that what they are expressing is their Jewish personality, their Jewish persona, their Jewish needs are doing. And for the book, right, as a book of kind of social history, we felt that we had to include at least a mention of this ritual of the bar mitzvah. Okay, and by the way, Caleb turns 13 next month, and so, God willing, and so, yeah, I'll let you know where you can send your gifts. So, but the idea here, again, that there is, you know, there are classical texts, and that there is a kind of an opposing view that describes dogs and Jews as very close, you know, infuses all time periods of Jewish history. Now, some of the folks who are writing throughout Jewish history in those classical texts try to push the dog out. All right, let me give you an example. In my article, I talk about the writings of a character called Saadi Gaon, who, in his biblical commentary and translation, very carefully removes the image of the dog and instead puts some uses some kind of grammatical hijinks. When the book of Exodus explains that, "But not a dog shall snarl at any of the Israelites, at man or beast, in order that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel," the intensity of the dog's snarling is palpable. Yet the commentary of Saadi Gaon on a number of biblical verses serves to remove the dog from the picture, perhaps because the dog itself may have sat on the margins of the Islamic society in which Saadia took part. By the way, just as a kind of digression, you see on the cover, right, the dog living on the periphery of the medieval city, right, looking at himself, right? Of course, because humans and dogs had a relationship that extends farther in history than any other species. That is to say, even before grains were domesticated, dogs were domesticated, right? The dog is pretty much as close to a human as one can get without being human. In fact, psychologists today will often use canine behavior as a proxy for human behavior instead of primate behavior. Even though we may be genetically closer to primates, right? That behavior that we see in dogs, right, is you know, almost as close as we can get to humans. So what we have is, you know, the other looking at himself in the, you know, in the river that's outside the medieval city. But of course, in the medieval Christian city at least, right, the Jew is as close to being integrated in society as you can get, and yet not integrated, right? So that is to say, you have the view of the other looking at himself, and even though it's a dog here, of course, what we have in mind is the idea of the Jew looking at himself outside the city and seeing a dog. Okay, so Saadia Gaon, another part of the world, says, right, trying to remove the dog from the Bible. His translation of the second hemistich of Psalms 22:21, "Save my life from the sword, my only one from the clutches of a dog," reads instead, "My only one from one who rages against it." The dog's gone there. The Judeo-Arabic of "one who rages" relies on the tenth form of the word kaflambe, which might leave the reader thinking of the dog, right, kelev or kalb in Hebrew and Arabic, but the dog itself has disappeared. As noted by Ibn Ezra in his commentary to this verse, the image of the dog here harkens back some four verses in the same psalm. "Dogs surround me. A pack of evil ones closes in on me." However, Saadia's translation of that hemistich calls out instead, "from that which encompasses me like dogs," in Judeo-Arabic, "ke-kilab," all evildoers which surround me. The translation once again removes the dog and puts in their place something like a dog. Okay. Therefore, again, we have the classical texts kind of forcing out the dog. And yet, over the scope of Jewish history, right, we've seen since the Industrial Revolution particularly, right, the dog enter the home and occupy a place of personhood, right, that it didn't occupy before. And so this is, I think, why you know, why our needs, our spiritual needs as a 21st century American Jewish community, tend to begin thinking about the dog in human terms, in terms of adoption rituals and burial rituals and so on. So you know, that I think is kind of a good survey of what the book as a whole does. That, you know, again, we go through all these periods in Jewish history and we're asking ourselves, how is it that that this image of the dog is important? I gave a talk at NYU this morning, and my colleague Jeff Rubenstein, who many of you know, said, "Phil, why don't you write about Jews and salt shakers, right? What is it about the image of the Jew and the dog throughout Jewish history?" And I think it is that relationship between Jews and dogs. Someone said, I think it was you earlier, said they didn't have salt shakers in antiquity, you know, and so therefore you couldn't write that book. I think it is because the dog is on the margins of human society, and therefore the Jew, who also on certain margins of certain societies, can look at the Jew the Jew's own self as the other, and the dog as the other's other. And therefore, I think it's a kind of useful heuristic for looking at the image of how Jews see themselves throughout history. I think it's probably as good a place as any to kind of stop and take questions, which I'm sure you guys have, be interested in hearing some of your own experiences about dogs. The book is something that kind of lends itself to popular appeal. But I have to say I'm very proud of the fact that our contributors are deeply immersed in the scholarship of their own field. I'm very proud of the quality of the scholarship and work. Yes.
Our liturgy and our texts are filled with imagery of sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And where there's sheep, there's usually a dog
that
helps the shepherd.
Yeah.
So because of that, I've always been sort of puzzled at the lack of positive image of the dog in what few classical texts
Right. So when I spoke earlier at NYU, Mark Smith, who's a scholar of the ancient Near East, pointed out that the word, Kalb, or, of course, from whom the biblical figure Caleb takes his name, right, does mean in ancient Near Eastern texts, as it does with respect to the character Caleb, someone who is quite loyal. Right. And so there are some positive images that rely on that same root. Okay, but whether or not that is the portrayal of the dog qua dog, right? I think you're right that it seems to be pushed out. At the same time, as you see throughout the book, dogs are a concomitant not only of rural settings where there might be a pastoral role for them, but also in urban settings. In fact, in a Geniza document that I found, a document that had been kind of disused, shoved away in the corner of a synagogue in medieval Egypt. It seems that people are talking about their daily life, and they said, and one of them says to another, "Well, the news about your family came to me. Everyone is talking about it, just like the dogs barking in the street." So it's very clear, right? The dogs are fulfilling some kind of role in that society. Maybe as guard dogs. Maybe they're just on the loose. But there is some kind of presence, an urban presence that's palpable. Okay. Other questions, comments? Yeah. In.
Hi. So I remember asking my family, what's the thing with dogs, and somebody had suggested, they use them to attack us. So I'm wondering about dogs as weapons. Maybe were they disallowed, or they used by our persecutors?
Sure. So. Yeah, my colleague Rakef Zelachik, my co-editor, wrote an article on the film Azit HaKalba HaTzanchanit, Azit the paratrooper dog, right? So perhaps a couple of you have seen this film. It's I think the film itself is from the 1970s. The book that preceded it, the book series about Azit, the German Shepherd heroine, right? So again, using the very same breed of dog that those folks watching the film might have thought of as associated with perhaps the Nazis, right, is taken, and actually a female dog, right, is used as a weapon in that she's trained to save Israeli soldiers, right, and in fact, there are a few soldiers who were captured, and then Azit does a parachute drop, and she saves them, and so on. So, I don't think you can find this film on Netflix, but it is out there, right? And in fact, again, General Motagul, who wrote the book, wrote a whole series about Azit. So there you see, actually, a kind of shifting away from the dog as a presence in Jewish society and a presence in Israeli society, right? That is to say that there, Azit is seen as, part of the Israeli military, and therefore, I think it merits inclusion there. We see a kind of shifting in the trajectory. One of the other articles in the book on the by Susan Kahn at Harvard talks about a breed called the Canaanite dog. Right, so the Canaanite dog in the article is described as a kind of key piece in Israeli nation building. And so there's a kind of a transformation, and dogs are used not as a weapon, but as a tool for Israeli identity. Yeah, please.
I'm thinking in a spiritual sense. I remember an article about Buber and how he described that when he was a little boy, he would visit a farm. Mm-hmm. And he put his hand on the cow, in this case. Mm-hmm. And he somehow felt the life force in that he had not ever been sensitive to before.
Wow.
And I think of that with my dog, that there is that aspect. It's not just a sociological thing. But there it's life, and penning it, it's not human life, but it is a living creature, and being aware of that part of it is, I think, a spiritual experience that that could be developed.
Again, I think that that is, you know, part of the direction of how we think about, you know, humanity, you know, not necessarily regard humanity as people, but there is a way in which we are thinking about you know, others as having a kind of subjectivity, right, that perhaps we didn't before. And so that's, again, why I think the book makes an important contribution, right, because we're seeing the dog as a kind of subject instead of just as something that doesn't carry that life force as a pure object. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and is there any relationship between Cain and Canaan? I read someplace that there was a etymological.
Between canine and canine?
Yeah.
I have no idea. That's very interesting. I have no
idea. I think horrible. That would be interesting. It's horrible.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Even like group, yeah.
Wow.
You can look it up. We have a library here.
Cliff, don't know.
Someone who's not a dog lover. I can say here. Someone who's bitten by a dog named Menchie, who's 5 years old.
Right.
Anyway. He made the analogy of the dog is sort of a metaphor. I like that very much because, I mean, there's a sense, I mean, it's also, it's an other, right? And I see that
it's also
someone who, but, you know, both the Jew in society and the dog, you know, there's a degree of otherness and there's a degree of acceptance in society. I think they're very, very different, right?
Yeah.
The level of acceptance we would want is very different than the way we would want to treat. I mean, the dog is an animal. You don't want it to have a bargain, right? I mean, that troubles you.
Well, it's, you know, it clearly doesn't trouble everybody, right? So let me show you ways in which the image of the dog and my colleague Ken Stowe from the University of Haifa has an entire book on the dog, the Jew as dog, and he's got an article in this collection as well. Let me read some homilies against the Jews, right? A little selection here in which Jews are described as dogs. Right, which is, again, you know, a piece from late antiquity, which is, I think, getting that particular ball rolling, which I think is, you know, at least in our reading, kind of present here, too. When Christ said, it is not fair to take the children's bread and to cast it to the dogs, and, as by then all agreed, the bread in question was the Eucharist, he meant that although these Jews had been called to the adoption of sons, they fell to kinship with dogs, while we who were dogs received the strength through God's grace to put aside the irrational nature which was ours, and to rise to the honor of sons. Once the Jews were the children, and the Gentiles dogs. But see how thereafter the order was changed about. They became dogs, and we became the children. Here's Stowe's comment. Hence, Jewish actions were to be shunned, their synagogues, and their very company disdained. Indeed, whereas Jews were once the pure adepts of Ezekiel's altar, they were now impure and a source of contagion. The lamp of purity had passed to Christian hands. That may be actually a different textual version of John Chrysostom's talk. Right? So the idea that the dog, that the Jew is the dog and is the other, right? Again, is part of this kind of adversus Judaeus literature, which is of late antiquity. Right? So I think what we're drawing on in the book is taking that image and perhaps using it fruitfully to say if the Jews have been termed as dogs, then maybe how the Jews themselves see dogs can teach us something about the Jews and their place in society as a whole. Right? And throughout, I think, the way that the Jews respond to the image of the dog is very much about their context. Right? Sadi Gaon, writing in Islamic lands in the 9th and 10th century, right, where dogs are pushed to the side, wants to push them to the side, right? Whereas in 21st century America, where the dogs have come into the house and we give them a kind of aspect of subjectivity, so too, right, do we start to have bar mitzvahs, we begin to think about them as people. So I think that, you know, we're kind of hopefully, fruitfully, continuing on that image and maybe turning it on its head instead of the Jew as dog, asking how does the Jew view the dog and what does that say about who the Jew is in the society in which it's found itself? Yes, Daniel.
What examples do you come across of dogs in the general category of non-kosher animals and how that might come into play? Because I know that, like, for Chabad, there's some custom that regarding that.
You know, to be honest, yeah, go ahead.
Transmigration of souls into non-kosher animals, and dogs would fall into that category.
Yeah, I'm afraid, we don't have someone in the book writing about the mystical aspect of dogs, and therefore, that's not really, transmigration of souls is not really addressed in the book, but... I don't think we're contextualizing dogs in terms of all unkosher animals, but instead looking at this one piece, right? There's only so much you can do in a collection, but here, because it's about dogs, we're really focusing on that image, not how they look. So, but tell me a little bit more about this idea that, how have you seen Chabad characterize dogs as different?
I know that, for instance, this is an example that you're familiar with, that at a certain school, when a dog was brought in,
was this the dog? Okay. Okay.
There was some objection by some Chabad families as regarding being under the same roof as an animal that was not a kosher animal.
Yeah. So, again, I don't know how Chabad treats dogs in their hierarchy of non-kosher animals. So, that's not really, yeah.
You know what's interesting about this, and had it occurred to me, but, the dog itself may be, like other animals, mm-hmm. designated as quote-unquote impure, meaning mm-hmm. It's not a kosher animal, it's an unkosher animal. But there's, of course, nothing about the impure animals, including the dogs, that would make it convey impurity. That's on the
correct.
One hand.
Right. Except in Islam, of course, that right. dog spit, conveys impurity, well, and then you have to rewash and stuff. Yeah.
Right. I'm thinking, but in the Jewish side, there is discussion. I don't think of dogs in particular, but it would pertain in particular to dogs because of their place in society, mm-hmm. of animals who are carrying pieces of carcass, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right, and including human carcass, and would therefore actually be carriers and conveyors
right.
of impurity.
Yeah.
And there's actual discussion if it's in the cavity of the mouth, if it's inside and outside, how does that affect it, and so forth.
Yeah.
So dogs might literally be spreading impurity in a way that would
so,
cause
it. Right, so what's interesting is that becomes a problem when the dogs are actually present.
Right.
So, those animals that are not present, right, it's maybe a theoretical problem, but it's not actually a practical problem. But, what that suggests is, the dogs are marginal, but they're only marginal because they're really present in the city, right? And so, present in the Jewish environment. And so, that is, again, I think something we see throughout the book, that there's an inherent tension, right? The dogs are pushed to the side, but they can only be pushed to the side because they really are very close to Jews.
Does anyone discuss cats and dogs as opposed to cats?
Well, Josh Schwartz, whom I mentioned before, who contributes, right, has a number of articles on dogs and cats in Jewish society in late antiquity. So, he can certainly move on. But again, given that Jews and Salt Shakers isn't going to fly as a book, I'm not sure that Jews and cats would work in the same way that Jews and dogs works, right? Again, this long association with dogs throughout Jewish history makes for this topic as a particularly interesting for reflecting on how Jews think of themselves. So, yes?
Any discussion about Jews and bestiality in the book? I know it's discussed in the Gemara, Thinking Above and Messiah, that women, widowed women, are not allowed to have dogs because of fear of bestiality.
Yeah. So Josh Schwartz discusses, and I believe Sophia Menashe also discusses it in her article, which focuses primarily on the biblical material, but also kind of moves into rabbinic material as well. Yeah, so, dogs are dangerous for a number of reasons, right? One is that they can hurt you, but another is that, of course, they can, be used in bestiality. And so, yeah, we kind of touch on that. I have to say it's not a major part of the book. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Did you come across any examples in the ancient tradition of having living in the home space?
So, right, so...
question?
Are there examples from which period? So of the dog actually living in the home space, right? So it is my understanding that in medieval Egypt that houses were often built around a kind of a central courtyard, and that animals, including dogs, right, would have been in that central courtyard and probably served a guarding function being down there. And so, yes, right. In fact, you know, as I said before, right, the dog has to be a kind of urban concomitant because dog dung is used for certain purposes, particularly for tanning. Right, as you know, we were talking earlier on that I came across a rabbinic response. I'm asking if you have tefillin that are cured with something other than dog dung. Right? Are those tefillin kosher? Because tefillin, like all other forms of leather, are cured with various types of chemicals. One of those chemicals happens to be dog dung. So if it's cured with something other than dog dung, is it kosher? Right? So this suggests that dogs are, you know, in my article, which talks about dogs as not only protective but also productive, right? That one of the things that they are productive of is this chemical that can be used to tan hides. So it does seem that they are present because not only because they serve this economic function of guarding and herding for those who are outside the immediate urban area, right? But also that they're, you know, that they're used for tanning in another cell. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times today dogs can be used in a really therapeutic function.
Yes.
And they'll sleep with the foot of your bed.
Yeah.
And they never wake up. It doesn't sound like the connotation.
Yeah, that type of thing is pretty difficult to find in classical materials, right? You know, it certainly seems that in the industrial age that that the dog has really entered the home, right? And therefore has a kind of personality that it didn't have before. Whether or not it entered the home before that is, you know, a question, right?
If you don't mind.
Go ahead, please.
I'm thinking, we're so oriented toward text, but all of a sudden I was reminded that there are images in medieval manuscripts.
Yeah.
I thought of a particular manuscript that we have. It's actually 15th century, so mm-hmm. 1400s, Renaissance, Italian.
Yeah.
I mean, Jews, of course, are living like everybody around them, but images, table scenes.
Yep.
Representing the Seder, where there are
yes.
dogs.
Well, there's no question, right, that the piece from John Chrysostom, right, is describing dogs as being at the foot. Right, so at the foot of the, at their feet while they're eating. Sure.
In the home, then.
Yeah. Well, certainly around the table, right? But whether or not they're sleeping at your bed, right, is, you know, yeah. Please,
you know, there's a very famous painting called The Barbarous Betrothal mm-hmm. by Van Eyck, in which the dog is right in the center mm-hmm. of the painting, and that's from 14th century, 1450. Right. And the dog is very, I mean, there's a lot of painting mm-hmm. that has to.
Right, so you know, one thing that is becoming clear to me is that, you know, my colleague from NYU today said that he had come up with some cases, 16th, 17th century of, perhaps even earlier than this, of dog marriages in Spain, right? And a way in which dogs were used, all right, to kind of be like a kind of a counterpoint to humans, that they went through some kind of ritual marriage process and so on. I thought this was striking because it does, you know, even in a humorous way, ascribe to them an almost humanity that I was much more used to seeing in the modern period. Yeah?
The Sunday Review section in the Times yesterday had an article called Dogs Are...
Yeah, dogs are people. Yeah. Yeah, right. So, you know, now I think we're definitely moving in that direction. And so once again, you know, what is the next frontier for us? That's something that I think, you know, we have to be thinking about. Where, yeah, what direction is personhood going to go in our society? So dogs are people too. Now, one thing that we talk about in the introduction to the book is that when we ascribe human emotions to dogs, right, what we're really doing is projecting onto the dog, right, our own emotions. Does the dog really think that way? I can tell you, my dog may or may not be loyal, but he's really thinking about food all of the time, right? And so if I think that he's thinking about anything other than food, I'm probably wrong, right? Thank you. And so, you know, I think that's why, again, I think that this was a particularly fruitful image for us to explore, because it shows the way in which we as humans have been projecting onto this creature to which we have been very close throughout our history, our own sense of what it means to be a person. Yes, 1-2.
In terms of going forward, so I mentioned a therapeutic effect.
Yeah.
Science is developing about animal therapy.
Yeah.
My dog, BB, named after BB, came out BB, and that was animal assisted therapy at Mount Sinai Hospital, going to visitation. And that's the way of doing something that I personally wouldn't be comfortable doing, before calling visiting stranger. Now
yeah.
We'll call it Barker Cone.
Nice. Yeah.
We're visiting patients, And that's a very Jewish thing, but integrating God in ways that we may not have otherwise seen it.
Yeah.
But that's only a factor of kind of modern approaches.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. As a rabbi.
Yeah.
I assume you're not a congregational rabbi.
Correct.
But if you were to speak to a congregational rabbi.
Yeah.
And have a lot of congregants with dogs, and they were interested in doing something, what would you recommend?
Well, you know, the article by Aubrey Glaser, who is a congregational rabbi, you know, I think is really important for this because he talks about rituals. And in fact, there's a lovely little footnote here that it's just a line. Let me read it to you. He says, as a congregational rabbi, hold on, let me find it. Full disclosure, as a scholar rabbi, I have encountered more questions surrounding rituals for dogs as a rabbi leading a conservative. Did I read this before? Okay. As a rabbi leading a conservative community than as a scholar researching in the academy. So I think it's really important that that article on contemporary Jewish American rituals for dogs, written by a rabbi and not by an academic, right, who may not even have access to the types of questions that are being asked about dog rituals, right? And so I do think that that spiritual need to mark the incorporation of an animal into our families, to mark the passing of an animal, you know, I think that it's really there, and I think it behooves, you know, the folks in the rabbinate to develop these ceremonies and perhaps to kind of exercise the kind of control so that the content in them, I think, reflects, you know, what they, as you know, the rabbinic elite, would like to see, instead of seeing the bark mitzvah, which, you know, if you watch it again on YouTube, it's a little bit campy, and I think you know, maybe is you know, some folks kind of thumbing their nose at traditional practice. That I think rabbis can move into this breach and can help create something that meets the spiritual needs of the Jewish people in these areas. Yeah. Apparently last night was yesterday was the Saint, yeah, yeah.
St. Francis, I think they're maybe doing a connection with Noah Parshanoah.
Yes. Right, right. Perfect time for us to, you know, kind of talk about this. And again, what that does for us is it shows how the environment in which we you know, we find Judaism as throughout history been shaped by you know, those connections. And I think that in these, you know, throughout the book, we find that relationship has been interesting and fruitful, and it lets us into this kind of, you know, connection between humans and dogs. I think ultimately it tells us a little bit about ourselves as Jews and as humans. So, yeah.
Two quick comments. One is our rabbi, I didn't mention many names, the senior rabbi in our congregation years ago. When our current rabbi, Lord, was sick, mentioned the dog's name, Mishabera.
You must come from Aubrey's congregation. Yeah. You know, he talks about that exact story. Yeah, yeah.
And the second one is, if you look at the image of dogs in the Gemara, it's a very negative image. And this idea of dogs being, you know, in the home and part of the family, I don't know that's real. I mean, I think that's the exception in the Middle Ages, rather than the usual case.
Well, remember, we don't argue that dogs were in the home and part of the family, right? That is to say, they may be part of the home, but, you know, the shape of the home is very different from what we think of as a home, right? That is to say that you're talking about a home built around a courtyard. There may have been animals in the courtyard. You know, there may have been an oven in the middle of the courtyard, right? So, you know, it's very different from what we think of as a living space, right? Living space might have been upstairs and so on. So, you know, just because the dog is in the urban setting, in the urban setting, and participating in the life of the family, doesn't mean that the dog is living like a human in the rooms where humans are living.
I mean, the idea of pets. I think the definition was established. I can't remember by whom. But there were three characteristics. The animal isn't eaten.
Mm-hmm.
The animal has a name, and the animal lives indoors. And this comes from England in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time people really have pets.
Right, right. And so there are transformations, and as I said, I think we see them in the literature. On the other hand,
you know, there, as I said, there is a kind of aspect of subjecthood and almost humanity that comes about in these, you know, in various dog marriages and so on that, that we see in Spain that I mentioned before. Yes, one, two, three.
So in terms of what you're talking about, the study of, you know, dogs being kind of part of just everyday life,
mm-hmm.
is there a difference between the urban Jew, let's say, in Europe, and the shtetl Jew,
yeah.
who might have dogs for work and for other things? You know, the distinction between a dog as a pet versus a dog as a member of kind of the work environment.
Yeah, again, you know, we don't have much evidence for dogs as pets before the modern period, right? And so, you know, and it's always hard as a medieval historian to try and figure out what's going on in the urban area versus what's going on in the rural area. Obviously, different sets of occupations, but I think in both cases, right, whether it's sheep herding in the rural areas or it's guarding in the urban areas, there are dogs in both of these settings. So, you know, the relationship is that the dog is still, you know, one of the animals in the animal family, right? And but as to whether or not there's a relationship that's closer with the humans is not really clear.
Well, that's what I was just wondering, whether prohibitions against Jews owning land mm-hmm. and things contributes somehow to the, you know, the lack of connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Between Jews and dogs.
Right. So, look, actually, my current research project is actually looking at Jewish involvement in agriculture and possibly their urbanization in Iraq in the early centuries of Islam. And one thing that I argue is just because Jews might not be owning land, not that they couldn't own land, but they might not own land, doesn't mean they're not involved in agriculture. And so it is possible that even if there were cases in which Jews were prohibited from owning land, right, it doesn't mean that they're no longer involved in agriculture. And therefore, it doesn't mean that they no longer have dogs involved in you know, their economic life. So that's a kind of important distinction that I'm trying to massage that I think some of my colleagues have missed. Again, I'm looking at particularly in Iraq, but and in the, you know, 8th to 10th centuries, but I think in other periods of Jewish history too, it's really important to make that distinction. So, yeah, Alex.
And so, in dogs love, and I'll tell you why I raised this question.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I had a very Catholic teacher. And we were discussing Silas Marner, which had mm-hmm. a dog in it. And a friend of mine named Susan contended that dogs could love, mm-hmm. and that had, you know, emotion. And the teacher went absolutely ballistic.
Yeah.
He said dogs did not have souls.
Yeah.
They were incapable of love. They were animals.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the argument was so vociferous in my classroom
yeah.
that it literally drove the student out of the school and sent her to Brock School because she was so heartbroken
wow.
over
wow.
the idea that dogs could not love because she knew that they loved
yeah.
her.
Yep.
And that she loved her dog back. And I think that if you're talking about the whole idea of the dog as other, or mm-hmm. the dog as a substitute for human behavior, or vice versa. Do you love your dog? You know, we can say humans love their pets.
Right, right.
But is the love coming back? The dog
right.
snuggles you, curls up in bed, licks your face, helps you wake up in the morning. Is that dog exercising love or habit?
Right. So, I'm not capable of answering that question, but I can say that it is extremely likely that we impute human behavior, or rather human motives, to behaviors that look like human behaviors, but really have a whole different set of motives, usually involving food. Yeah.
The researcher was training dogs.
Yeah.
MRI.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
what I find really interesting about this is that the science may be driven by our idea of what a human is, right? That is to say that this type of question, right, the researcher didn't ask if fish can love, right, or if computers can love, but really, can dogs love, right? And the reason that comes up is because we are we're asking this question because we're thinking about whether or not dogs can love, because we think about them as a reflection of ourselves. And so, you know, again, the science is driven by, it's not entirely disinterested in cults, but there's a way in which the questions that we ask in science are driven by the sense of what is human.
But the question is, why are we asking
those
questions about the dog?
Yeah, right, exactly. And again, I think that goes back to this tremendous and long relationship we've had.
And of course, the question is, who's walking whom?
Yeah, right? Yeah, always. Okay, one or two more. Yeah, one.
Just a comment on the dog. I didn't read the article. I am
a
veterinarian. Uh-huh. And I know that dogs have been evolved and bred.
Yes.
Their goal is to please their owner.
Yes.
They think about all the time.
Yes.
All they want to do is please their owner.
Yes.
Snuggling pleases the owner, they're going to do it.
Thoughts
go beyond food.
Can you tell me why my dog digs in the garbage then? Because that does not please his owner. Yeah.
That's
good food. Yeah, they're all thinking about food. That's all they're thinking about. They're not thinking about pleasing me, they're thinking about food. You know? Yeah. I just think about it. If you had to think about only one thing all the time, right, you know, it would be.
Well, it's actually, there was a study produced by the BBC a number of years ago. You can rent this.
Yeah.
I think it's just called Dogs or something like that. Where they examined, they were able to find that the human face, which appears to be, what's it called on both sides?
Symmetrical.
When it registers emotions, is not symmetrical. Mm-hmm. One side, I don't remember if it's the right or the left, is it the right, registers the emotion in a way that makes it more visible. Humans do not know how to pick this up.
Yeah.
But they examined dogs and found that dogs naturally look to that side of the face, meaning that dogs can understand human emotion before humans can.
But it doesn't mean that they experience those emotions themselves.
No, right? But it's the only thing they're thinking about is not the food, that's all.
Right, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
Did you find that there was a difference of how Jews experienced dogs in the medieval Muslim world as opposed to Ashkenaz?
So, for better or for worse, the two articles that we have, mine is, my article is about Jews in the medieval Islamic world, Ken Stowe's is about Jews living in medieval Christian Europe, right? But the articles are sufficiently different, right? I look at the dog, and Ken Stowe looks at the Jew as dog. And so you can't sit and look at one versus the other. But, but certainly, the dog is seen as marginal in both cases. Right. Again, a source of impurity in the Islamic world, the ones who are picking up the crumbs in the Christian world. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah, Karen. Where's Marley, by the way? Right, so dogs can make people ill, but as Josh Schwartz pointed out, dogs can be eating things and eating people too. And so if they're basically untrained, there are all kinds of other potential problems, right? I hear that the dog's mouth is cleaner than my mouth, so I'm not sure to what extent. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Ask a vet.
Mm-hmm. Well.
No, it won't come. I want to comment back there. Rambam writes about rabies.
Yeah.
And he knows the symptoms, he has it all right, and people are afraid of dogs.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In medieval Egypt, in Rambam's time, rabies is a real thing and a real fear. And this leads to other fears about dogs.
There you go. Okay. So, thanks very much. Let me close with one little piece from the last article where we talk, where Kat Baker and I talk about how to use this the book in an undergraduate classroom. These practical techniques will help your students connect with the material in A Jew's Best Friend. The fact that many of these techniques embody traditional Jewish modes of learning will enhance this sense of connection. Ultimately, though, for the impact of your class and this book to be strongest, students need to be engaged, not only as individuals learning to do scholarship, but also to see the connection between that scholarship and their personal lives. This sort of teaching is greatly enhanced through community centered teaching, which we'll review in the next and final section on classroom techniques. So the idea that this book, again, isn't just a work of simple, dry scholarship, but the next chapter of the book, if you will, on how we connect with the dog is yet to be written. Hopefully we'll encourage you guys to take a look and look at how the image of the dog has developed throughout Jewish history, and to think, particularly in light of Aubrey Glaser's article, what is it that our contemporary Jewish community needs spiritually in order to connect with, to commemorate our furry friends. So, thank you.
So, thank you for coming. We have got next month, the November, two book talks coming up. One relating to anti-Semitic images on postcards. The author collected this vast collection of postcards from the earlier 20th century, and it's just this fantastic range of very, very interesting images, which he will discuss. And then a little bit after that, Dara Horn will be coming. Dara Horn will be coming to discuss her new book, Guide for the Perplexed. So please come back for those, and thank you for coming this evening.
That's great, right?
Oh, I'm going to send you more stuff than you want to
know. Send me everything. Send me everything. Overwhelm me.
Oh, that's great.
What?
Which one are you?
My name is Jay Lieber.
I don't, do you practice in New York?
In Queens, yes.
Ah, that's why I don't know. Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Yeah.